proceed to the third case, Besour versus Indiana University. You may proceed, Ms. Goodson.
Good morning, Your Honors. And thank you for giving the plaintiff appellant an opportunity to address this court. You have our briefs, so I will not be spending the majority of my time going over what has already been written. What I want to say about this case, Your Honors, is whether it appears so or not, I think there is a crisis in our jurisprudence with respect to motions to dismiss. In the plaintiff appellant's brief, there was a brief history of how these motions to dismiss were handled up until the more recent decision of Bell Atlantic versus Twombly, and where the court still says we have a notice pleading system, and that it says there that we do not have heightened pleading, but it does state that the claim for relief must be beyond mere speculation and must, in fact, be plausible. Now, one of the problems with motions to dismiss is there is a great variation on whether or not they're granted. Some judges rarely grant them. Other judges often grant them. So if we're all looking at the same case law and judges are coming to different conclusions, perhaps there is some confusion about what the Supreme Court said. And I have no doubt that Mr. Brundage on the other side will be citing the same case law, but miraculously will be coming to different conclusions. I just want to point the court to the direction of a statement in Bell Atlantic that I think is very important. It does go on to say towards the end, I believe, that a plaintiff is not required to make out a prima facie case in its complaint. That's very important. It says that the plaintiff is required to advance such allegations that make his claim plausible. And it does not require the plaintiff to present evidence. So that is why at some points during the briefing, I've referred to this as a procedure that is more like summary judgment, because the district court in effect made some determinations based on evidentiary conclusions that we think are not required. This is not a case about professional judgment in the academic environment. We are stating that the plaintiff had a right to an education that was governed by his implied contract and to be free from state action that involved arbitrary and capricious behavior.
Well, Mr. Gaston, that's what troubles me about your complaint, though. You say it's not about academic judgment, but you allege that the grades that he received in these two courses, the D pluses, were arbitrary and departed from established norms. I don't know what that means. Well, what established norms? There's no real reference to those, and it sure sounds a lot like the Horowitz situation where the court tells us we don't go into these academic decisions.
Well, thank you, Judge Tender. It is different from the Horowitz case because we're not simply challenging whether or not he received fair grades. We're saying that he did not receive due process. That due process is not only set out by law because there is state action involved and state officials involved, but because there is an implied contract with the university. Now, it is not attached to the complaint, but the state cases have held that academic bulletins are appropriate sources of common law for determining implied contracts. So we're saying that not only under the standards of, for example, Matthews versus Eldridge and Perry versus Sinderman, I believe a Seventh Circuit case, we can show if this litigation is allowed to continue that established norms are violated.
Excuse me for interrupting, though. Nowhere in your briefing at the trial court or here have you laid out anything from the bulletins that gives your client any more procedures than they received in terms of the grades that he was given, the two D's, D pluses, and the F?
Right, but that is not
the
crux of our.
Where's the contract?
Well, the contract was not. When you say the contract, the bulletins were not attached to the complaint. But we believe that the notice pleading requirement did not require us to do so at that stage.
But you have to at least tell us what the promises are that the university made to him, and that's not spelled out. What promises were made that form the basis for the contract. That needs to be in the complaint.
Well, Your Honor, I think I respectfully disagree. I mean, there is a case, the Gordon case and the Neal case, where that might be an interpretation under Indiana law. But those cases, that case is a little bit distinguished. Number one, first there was a summary judgment in the Gordon case. And the plaintiff went back and with two amended complaints, and there was a motion to dismiss.
I'm not talking some. I'm just saying, you know, what is the contract? What was the promise that was made? We don't have to have affidavits to support it or anything. What is it in the university regulations, rules, those brochures that you had attached? That form the basis of the contract.
Right, Judge Williams. Well, those are laid out in the academic bill. The bulletins provide for specific procedures for challenging academic dismissal and grades and so forth. We're saying that he was not given an opportunity at all to follow those procedures. And we're saying that it is not clear to the plaintiff that that requirement exists, that that specific promise be laid out in the complaint. There is some case law, but that is state substantive law. The federal courts have not said that at the preliminary pre-discovery stage, you must lay out all aspects of your contract. In fact, it's not a requirement that you attach a contract. It is under Indiana state law, for example, if you're suing on a breach of contract, that you attach, Judge Tender knows well, the printed contract. But there is no such contract requirement under federal law. And under the Erie Doctrine, the federal procedure is to be followed in state substantive law. So when you're required to introduce academic bulletins or contracts, we believe is a matter of substantive law. And this case is not in the Indiana State Court. So the federal courts are not bound to, we don't believe, we're bound to follow that particular procedure when we don't know of no federal case that says you must introduce your academic bulletins and attach them to your complaint or specify or your motion to dismiss will be granted against you.
But your complaint, I'm sorry for interrupting, your complaint didn't say that your contract was based on the bulletins, did it?
Right.
No, it didn't, sir, but it did.
And nor did any of your arguments at the district court level.
Yeah, there were arguments that stated that had we been allowed to proceed through discovery, those academic bulletins would have been introduced.
But the thing is nothing in this, like, count two, this breach of implied contract. You talk about there's an existence of it.
Yes.
They breached it, that it was arbitrary. We need to know what was breached. It needs to be spelled out.
Okay, but we don't think there's authority for that position.
Was it an implied?
It's an implied contract, yes.
At law or at fact?
There is a difference. Implied in law and fact.
Both.
I think it's both. There is case law that academic bulletins on the federal
law. It doesn't matter what the bulletins say, right? If it's an implied contract at law, it doesn't matter what the bulletins say. It's not. Those are facts.
Well, the implied contracts at law are equitable contracts that are brought about by a need for justice. So under either scenario, we think the plaintiff would have been entitled to relief.
You want to reserve a little time, Mr. Gatson?
For a rebuttal, yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Gatson. Mr. Brundage.
May it please the Court, my name is Corey Brundage. I represent Indiana University, Kipley Drew, and Dr. Meets. And I want to speak directly to Mr. Gatson's argument because I believe there is direct federal authority, which in fact is cited in the Gordon and the Neal cases, which requires him to identify the specific broken promise. In his briefs, Mr. Bissasour maintains that all he had to allege was that he had an implied contract and the university did not deal in good faith. But as Judge Posner of this court said in Williams versus Wendler, I believe it was just 8 months ago, a student has to allege more than merely an entitlement to fair procedure. He first must establish an enforceable property right by contract. And the federal authority that I heard Mr. Gaston say is missing is Ross versus Creighton, upon which the Indiana cases of Gordon and Neal are based. So it is the law of this district, and it is the law of Indiana, that to establish an enforceable contract right in the student university context, and the Bell Atlantic standards are to be applied according to the context of each particular case. In the student university context, there are two requirements. First, the plaintiff must identify a specific contractual promise the defendant failed to honor. Second, because courts will not second-guess academic decisions, he must allege that the university completely failed to honor the promise, in the words of Ross, at all. So let's look at the plaintiff's complaint here. It not only fails to meet either Ross requirement, it includes allegations that plead Mr. Bissasour out of court, as the district court noted. In paragraphs 23 and 24, and this is the heart of his complaint, he mentions some D pluses he got, but those are so what's, because he then says he was allowed to retake courses and so on and so forth. The heart of his complaint is paragraph 23 and 24, where he admits that after he received an F in a clinical rotation, he was dismissed from the School of Optometry. Nowhere does he plead that that F, unlike the D pluses, was arbitrary or inappropriate. It does not say that in the complaint. He admits he got an F. He does not claim that was arbitrary. Then he takes a little detour in paragraph 25. Now, this is red herring. He says, I attempted to challenge the dismissal on several occasions via the policies and procedures ratified and adopted by IU, including those pertaining to the dismissal of graduate students. Now, the district court asked this question, what does that mean? Quote, does that mean he never actually challenged his grades in his dismissal or that he challenged them unsuccessfully? Now, one would think that the district court, having raised that question in her entry, that Mr. Bissasour would explain to this court, now on appeal, how it is that paragraph 25 states a cause of action. He does not. In his revised brief, page 8, he only says, apparently, on more than one occasion, Bissasour attempted to or threatened to challenge both his dismissal and his low marks. Again, he just repeats the statement. He doesn't say that it establishes a cause of action. He has clearly chosen not to specify what that paragraph means. But what is clear is that nowhere in the complaint does he allege that he was totally denied any opportunity to challenge his dismissal.
Because there are procedures at the university for hearings for graduate students if they are going to be expelled or to appeal an expulsion, or there's a process for expulsion.
Granted, there are. And Horowitz says the minimum constitutional requirement is an informal give and take where the student's allowed to state his side of the issue. Granted, there are. But what we can tell is that Mr. Bissasour here has failed the second leg of Ross. He does not allege anywhere he was denied that opportunity. He just says there were opportunities. So he moves on in paragraph 26 to say this, and this is where he fails to meet the first leg of Ross, in that he fails to identify a specific contractual promise that was broken. In 26, he says, IU and Drew have acted in bad faith and in an arbitrary and capricious manner by departing from established norms, undefined. Then he says, and refusing to allow Bissasour the opportunity to fully and fairly challenge his dismissal before an impartial decision maker. So paragraph 26 abandons the red herrings of ratified policies and procedures and vaguely alleges a departure from established norms. As the district court noted, it is not specified what these established norms were. It is clear, however, that merely invoking established norms does not satisfy Ross. And here's the federal case that I heard Mr. Gadsden say doesn't exist. This is Ross versus Creighton University from this court. Ross said, he used these words to describe what's necessary in the complaint. Identifiable contractual promise, explicit promise, specific promise, certain specific services, certain terms, specific and narrow claims. And in that case, they said Ross had identified five specific commitments. That's at page 417 of that case, spread out in their discussion. Clearly, just saying established norms does not satisfy Ross. Nor does the second independent clause in paragraph 26, after the and, supply or identify a specific promise. There he says, well, they refused to allow the opportunity to fully and fairly challenge a dismissal before an impartial decision maker. Now, this merely expresses Mr. Bissasour's preference for an impartial decision maker. It does not identify a specific contractual promise of such an impartial decision maker. And if you think about it, it's unlikely that any university says, we're going to allow review by someone who has no connection to the educational process or someone who knows nothing about the student. Who is an impartial decision maker? How would that be defined? There is no such identification of a source to a right for that. As this court said in Concentra versus EEOC, Bell Atlantic imposes two requirements. Complaint has to be sufficiently detailed to give fair notice, and it must plausibly suggest a right to relief, raising the possibility above a mere speculative level. The Bell Atlantic court said to enter the realm of plausibility, the complaint must cross the border between factually neutral and factually suggestive language. The allegation that his appeal was not to somebody that he viewed as impartial is factually neutral. So what? It's like the allegation of parallel contract in Bell versus Atlantic. So what? There could be plenty of reasons for parallel contract. To push this complaint, or conduct, to push this complaint over the border into plausibility would take a specific identification of a contractual right to an impartial decision maker. And he doesn't do that. Now, before this court, he implies in his appellate's brief, but he still does not specify how, there may be some bulletins which he admits he never mentioned to the district court that might be relevant. Even in his briefs to this court, he does not say these specific contractual promise to an impartial decision maker is in the bulletins, or the established norm, which is this, is in the bulletins. He just says there are some bulletins, they might be relevant. If those bulletins provide the necessary, identifiable, specific contractual right, why didn't he say so in the complaint? Why didn't he amend his complaint after he read the motion to dismiss and before the court ruled? Oh, I've got those, here they are. Would have solved the whole problem, if it exists. Or why not move for leave to amend after the judgment instead of coming here? But he came here, and he's still mysterious. We still haven't seen the source for this right. 13 days ago, this court in Heckler versus Deere said there is no reason to sit on potentially relevant evidence and then turn around and criticize a court for ruling without benefit of the same evidence. As this court said in Concentra, from, I believe, September of 2007, all a plaintiff is required to do is plead, quote, obviously important and easy to catalog facts. Accepting less promotes vagueness and rewards obfuscation. And another aspect of this case is it promotes delay, it promotes expensive discovery, it promotes expense, and this case also invokes qualified immunity, which must be ruled upon in the beginning. Providing easily provided and clearly helpful facts, as the court said, this court said in Concentra, facilitates a quick resolution on the merits. A quick resolution is especially appropriate in this case because these defendants are entitled to qualified immunity. Dismissal in the district court was appropriate. and we ask that it be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Brundage. Mr. Gadsden?
Thank you again, Your Honors. I must say at the outset, I have no personal knowledge as to why the complaint was not amended. I was not personally involved in the litigation until this very appeal. It's interesting, Mr. Brundage, he over and over says, well, about evidence not being presented. At this stage, pre-discovery, pre-summary judgment, it is not a requirement on the plaintiff's part to present evidence, but only to make allegations that are plausible beyond the mere speculative level. Now, when you look at due process, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and even with the looking at the adequacy of the complaint, you have to look at the parties involved. This is a university. This is not the first and not the last time that they will experience a lawsuit by a student challenging their dismissal. So it's not really plausible, if you will, that they would be surprised and not know that there are academic bulletins involved. There certainly are. And they are aware of these academic bulletins. The reason that they weren't attached to any sort of brief is we didn't know the proper mechanism to do so. And we still believe that the complaint by itself is adequate and that we need not plead a prima facie case. The fact that he mentions these academic bulletins that he's well aware of is something that we certainly could prove through discovery and through summary judgment. We believe the defendants are on fair notice about what this claim is all about, and that those academic bulletins will determine what the established norms are, and we would be able to, then to show that bad faith was involved and those procedures weren't followed.
Thank you, Mr. Gadsden.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Brundage. The case is taken under advisement.